You may have heard about the debate over intelligent design and Darwinism. Find out what the evidence says about the origin of life and mankind, and just what the experts are saying. Darwin or Design, brought to you by the C.S. Lewis Society. Now your host, the author of Doubts About Darwin and Darwin Strikes Back, the research professor of Bible and theology at Trinity College in Trinity, Florida, Dr. Tom Woodward.
Welcome to Darwin or Design, the program that tackles each week the head-on, the information coming out of the dialogue or the debate between the world of science and the world of philosophy and theology, and specifically Christian belief. And so it's a privilege to welcome you, if this is your first time, to come alongside and listen along. I am Tom Woodward, your weekly host. I'm delighted to present the case for design and the case, the growing case from the world of scientific evidence that has been building and mounting through the last several decades against the Darwinian, neo-Darwinian theory of evolution that says that the complexity and the diversity of life forms have developed through a long process of mindless step-by-step change to produce the amazing world we have around us today. So it's we also want to thank our host and sponsor. The C.S. Lewis Society has been sponsoring for the last year and a half, and I might even add my kudos and hats off to Bill Carl, our technical producer, across the table from me here at the Salem Tampa Station. We do have an extraordinary guest on the other end of the line. He is a Ph.D. graduate in philosophy, specializing, I think, in the area of mathematics, but we'll get down to the details of that, who is, a Ph.D. in philosophy grad from Princeton, my alma mater. But he is also an accomplished, he's a Renaissance man. He's done so many things, written very, very important books on the history of mathematics. He has just come out with a new book called The Devil's Delusion, something I would think of a response to Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, but it goes beyond that into a whole range of considerations. But we want to welcome to the other end of our line, out in, Washington State, is that right, Dr. Berlinski?
For today, yeah.
For today, and as you rove from here and there in a tour of cities in the United States, I gather. You are a professor, or have been in many different locations, both in the U.S. and overseas, a professor of mathematics primarily, or philosophy, which...
Both, really.
Okay.
Take whatever I can get.
Well, you know, Dr. Berlinski, of course, I'm tempted to call you David because we've known each other for a number of years. We first met at the Biola Conference, which really in 1996, November 96, out in L.A., helped to hammer out some of the broad outlines of the new emerging paradigm, the approach of intelligent design, detecting design in physical systems. But if you could just share a little bit about your personal background, I mean, how you got interested in the issue of metaphysics, the possibility of the showing the non-existence of God, or even the plausibility of that there may be some higher power, and then how you got interested in the physical side of it, the scientific side of things.
Well, my interest in the physical sciences, and especially mathematics, is long-standing. I mean, after all, I graduated from Princeton in 1965. That was a very long time ago, and I immediately switched my interests from philosophy, which were considerable at the time, and I like to think they, well, perhaps it's an exaggeration, I like to think they were serious, and I switched my interests from philosophy to mathematics, especially mathematical logic, and I really stayed committed to these fields for a long time. I taught mathematics at half a dozen different universities. I taught it over in France. And I became very, very deeply interested in certain kinds of questions, which are no longer, I think, of anything but historical or autobiographical interest. And it was only after I published A Tour of the Calculus in 1996 and decided to really commit myself to writing about the things that interested me that very gradually I developed an interest in the kind of issues that are being discussed in my book, The Devil's Delusion, Atheism and Scientific Pretensions. I'm not going to argue that these are very long-standing interests. Late in life, I came to them.
And that's published by Crown...
Crown Forum.
Very good. Well, I just received my copy within the last 3 hours.
Not surprising. It hasn't reached the bookstores yet.
Well, that's great. It's the FedEx brought it faithfully as I was going into my class on C.S. Lewis this morning. Tell me, just to back up just a little bit, you did your original work, of course, in Ph.D. in Princeton in philosophy. I think you knew Walter Kaufman. He was even instrumental in you somehow getting into that department.
Walter Kaufman and I met before I came to Princeton, and we talked, and I think at the time, don't forget, he was very interested, completely occupied with continental philosophy. And at the time, we discussed continental philosophy, and he asked me very politely, would I be interested in continental philosophy? And at the time, since I knew nothing about it, I said, sure. I don't know whether this was decisive interest in my gaining admission to the department. Mm-hmm. That's a little unclear to me because, well, the fact of the matter, it was a long, long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't get to the department.
Right. When I was there in 68 through 72, I actually took his course, Hegel, Nietzsche, and Existentialism. And he was, of course, one of the world's leading authorities, especially on Nietzsche, and I guess the other two topics as well, and himself, both of Jewish descent, but atheist in belief. But he had the high regard for the Old Testament prophets. I remember reading, his feeling, his passion of some sense of a higher morality reflected in those prophets. I always thought was kind of in discord with his own
department. You're so right. Walter Kaufman, he was an interesting and a valuable member of the department. There's no question about that. But in some respects, he was anachronistic. He looked back, or he participated in memory in a particular kind of scholarly tradition, which was completely inaccessible to the men running the department at the time. They had no interest in it. They certainly didn't want to master the languages involved, German or French. And they were very reluctant to give it any credibility. Kaufman was appreciated for what he represented, the sole representative in the department of that tradition. But he was not an active member. He was not a significant voice during my time there. This may have all changed after I left.
Right. But, of course, now, when you emerge from that experience in philosophy and you turn toward mathematics, and your book, Tour of the Calculus, I believe, won a national award. But you have then since written a number of articles, I believe, in various and sundry places, including commentary on the Darwin issue. Wasn't that your first big...
Yeah, it was the second piece I did in commentary. The first was called The Soul of Man Under Physics. It was quite a different piece. But the Deniable Darwin was the piece I published in 1996, and that was the piece that really created an enormous uproar.
Mm-hmm.
Just an enormous amount of controversy.
Well, you seem to be maybe creating uproars in different locations. One of the uproars that's going to be this as the program that we're taping just right before it airs is coming out. The new movie, Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, featuring Ben Stein, is also featuring our own David Berlinski on the phone with us.
Very, very small amount.
Small amount, but I enjoy the pose in your chair at your department. My wife and I thought it was so cool the way you are able to recline and then at the same time deal a fairly good critical comment or present a critical comment on Darwinian macroevolutionary theory. Tell us a little bit about your skepticism of that theory.
You mean as it was reflected in
as it was reflected there,
reclining armchair, yeah. Well, you know, my skepticism, I have to say, in my own defense, is really of long standing. It began at Princeton, of all places. I was at the time rooming with a very, very sharp philosopher. And he made one effort after the other to explain Darwin's theory to my satisfaction and to his. And we discovered, after a couple of months of discussion, that the theory was largely opposed. When you peeled away the carapace and you got to the theory itself, there was virtually nothing there. And I left Princeton. I said, that's odd, because everyone seems to believe in Darwin's theory of evolution. It seems absolutely as well established as any other part of science. How could it be that I can't understand it? And I understood a lot of difficult things at the time, with a great deal of effort, of course, but I simply could not figure out what was going on in Darwin's theory because it seemed to me strikingly empty. No real scientific content. And the next person I talked to was Noam Chomsky at MIT. I interviewed him for the New York Times, and he said he shared my skepticism at the time. He's since backtracked a little bit. He told me to go see Marco Schutzenberger, a mathematician in Paris, and I did. And Marco and I really... found that we had an absolute concordance of opinion with respect to Darwin's theory. He was infinitely more skeptical and derisive than I was, and I learned to be much more like him in my attitudes. And that was the crucial influence. Marco really, and not only me, I think he opened a lot of eyes.
And Marco Schutzenberger, of course, a member of the French Academy of Science.
Oh, yeah, he's a terrific mathematician. Yeah. Excellent mathematician.
A mathematician and medical degree, I believe, as well.
He was originally a physician, yeah. A world expert on yaws.
Now, wasn't Schutzenberger a member of the notorious Wistar Institute?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Murray Eden and Schutzenberger were both there, and they both contributed what I think of as historically important papers.
I just interviewed, or I didn't really interview, I chatted with Murray Eden last week on the phone, and he and I are going to try to get together for an interview in the next month or so. And he says, my comments all along have been that neo-Darwinism is just plain sloppy. It's not, it's not rigorous.
I agree.
Now, what do you see happening in the next couple months or years down the road? Are we reaching a critical point where the lack of rigor in neo-Darwinism is becoming known more widely?
Well, if I could offer one small correction, when you use a phrase like the lack of rigor, it sounds as if you're applying to neo-Darwinian theory the standards of pure mathematics. That's not the case, and I don't think Murray Eden means it that way.
Right.
We're using ordinary scientific standards of rigor, ordinary degrees of plausibility and coherence and consistency. Mm-hmm. Nothing very exceptional. The same standards you might apply in chemistry or in physics.
Mm-hmm.
And it's to that extent that neo-Darwinism, I think, is very, very deficient. What's going to happen in the next 4 or 5 months, 4 or 5 years? It's very hard to say. I think everyone who is engaged in a critical assessment of Darwin's theory has been stunned by the extraordinary nature of the counter-reaction. It's foolish on our part. We should have expected it, but I don't think anyone really did.
Mm.
And the counter-reaction, contre force majeure, if you will, the counter-reaction has not been really a scientific counter-reaction, not largely a scientific counter-reaction, although there have been some very perceptive criticisms offered. It has been an ideological counter-reaction.
In other words, coming from the Darwin side?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Coming from the Darwin side, the reaction has been overwhelmingly, I would say, ideological.
Mm-hmm.
And not critical or analytic. Although mm-hmm. I have to say that some very good pieces have appeared, mm-hmm. very critical pieces,
right.
including my own. I have participated right. in criticisms. I have argued that intelligent design has certain deficiencies that mm-hmm. need to be addressed.
And you're listening to Darwin or Design. I'm Tom Woodward talking to David Berlinski, the author of the new book, The Devil's Delusion, and one of the key figures in a movie coming out this very weekend, which is called Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. And the best in our interview with Dr. Berlinski is yet to come. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Darwin or Design. We have an exciting conversation going with David Berlinski. Dr. David Berlinski is the author of a new book, The Devil's Delusion, and it's subtitled Atheism and Its Scientific Pretensions. Dr. Berlinski, out there in California, actually, I guess, northwest. And,
in Seattle, yeah.
Seattle area. If you could just take us on a quick tour of some of your major insights, discoveries, points of view that you're really emphasizing in The Devil's Delusion. Just give us a little kind of mini seminar, if you could.
Well, I think my motivation for writing The Devil's Delusion after spending a whole long time in mathematics and physics and sciences and biology
mm-hmm.
is to correct the widespread misapprehension that the sciences offer us a coherent, intelligible, consistent worldview that makes any creedal commitment simply impossible. That's what really, and I hesitate to use this word, but it's accurate, that's what infuriated me after reading Dawkins and Hitchens and Daniel Dennett and all the rest of them. The idea that science speaks with a uniform voice and it has a single message, which I think is impossible to sustain if anyone has spent any time seriously examining the sciences. It's just an impossible point of view. And I regret to say that some very distinguished physicists whom I admire intensely, like Steven Weinberg, has participated in this. And all I can say about this is he certainly knows better.
Mm-hmm.
He certainly knows better.
Well, let me just read a couple from the flyleaf, on the front flyleaf at least. Has anyone provided a proof of God's inexistence? And then in red, not even close. Let me read one or two others. Has quantum cosmology explained the emergence of the universe or why it is here? Not even close. One more. Have the sciences explained why our universe seems to be fine-tuned to allow for the existence of life? Not even close. As you confront the escape route that I've heard so many physicists say, well, our universe is fine-tuned because there just has to be trillions and maybe an infinite number of other little bubble universes out there that were clunky, stupid, you know, ineffective, life-forbidding universes. What do you say to those?
I say it's a good try, but it's unpersuasive.
Mm-hmm.
First, because there's absolutely no evidence that those other universes exist.
Okay.
And second, to the extent that they are a part of the fiction of current quantum cosmology,
mm-hmm.
they arise for internal reasons that have nothing to do with the characteristic procedures of science. After all, physicists were moved to declare that there are 10 to the 500th possible solutions to the string vacua problem in string theory because they had no other way to deal with the embarrassing fact that the equations of string theory are not unique. They don't provide a solution. The existence of a solution is unique, let alone stable, as many physicists have all along claimed a set of solutions must be. And for that reason, they arise purely for internal reasons, something that every physicist who writes about this admits. For example, Leonard Susskind says, well, we don't have direct evidence of the impossible to have anything like direct evidence, but the whole structure is coherent. It's beautiful. It's mathematically invigorating. But you can say exactly the same thing about a house of cards, and I do. That is the characteristic of a house of cards. There's no contact with reality except the instability that causes it to collapse. A scientific theory, a profound scientific theory, cannot be built on this basis of internal coherence and consistency, where things are postulated to exist for no better reason than the theory demands they exist. That's simply not a way to proceed. We need some direct contact with reality if anyone is going to give up his belief in an alternative version of reality. That's an obvious point. It's an elementary point. It's not the first time that physicists have taken this route. Look, at the end of the 1920s, quantum mechanics and special relativity proved incompatible, and physicists, great minds like Paul Dirac, were forced to postulate such mechanisms as pair creation from a sea of possibilities. But the point about those speculations is that simply within 5, 6, 7 years, there was astonishing experimental confirmation of these ideas. Astonishing. Had there been no experimental confirmation during the 1930s, we would have regarded pair creation or annihilation operators in quantum mechanics as a dead end. In exactly the same way, we will regard the landscape of quantum possibilities, of cosmological possibilities, as a dead end if we cannot reach any kind of experimental confirmation. And because of the way the theory is built and the assumptions that go into the theory, it is almost impossible to imagine experimental confirmation. But a third and obvious point, if a physicist tells you, after reflecting on religious experience and religious beliefs, that in order to avoid an obvious inference from the fine-tuning of the fundamental constants to something like a fine tuner, he's going to postulate 10 to the 500th additional universes, we, the rest of us, are entitled to say this is a gross violation of Occam's razor. It's unwieldy, it's inelegant, and implausible, because you're not so much searching for a new idea as evading an old one. And that, to my mind, is unacceptable.
Right, and some of those listening may not be familiar with Occam's razor, but it's mentioned about 3 or 4 times in the movie Contact. And that's where, of course, we're reminded that the simplest solution, all things being equal, the simplest solution is best. Parsimonious thought is at a premium. And so the bloated ontology, I sometimes call it, of the multiverse, this multiple universe.
The landscape
seems to be not only undetectable, but itself really kind of like generated by a desire to escape one kind of implication, or at least one.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think the good physicists like Leonard Susskind admit this. And there's a quote I have in the book that if we cannot defend the landscape, if we cannot show that it really is a plausible physical idea, he says we will be very hard-pressed to answer ID critics.
Well, I've been amazed by that. I think I became aware of that quote just a few months ago. You're listening to David Berlinski on the phone with us from Seattle, Washington, where he's on a coast-to-coast, I guess, or at least extensive tour. I guess you're going
endless
to...
Endless is the word.
Endless. Well, your earlier interactions with intelligent design, I describe you, by the way, in Chapter 11 of Darwin Strikes Back, my book that came out about a year and 4 months ago.
Yeah.
As... one of intelligent design's unexpected allies, and in the sense that here you are, a graduate PhD from Princeton University in philosophy, later known for as an historian of mathematics, author of the book Tour of the Calculus, and many other great awards. I describe you as a rhetorician par excellence because you have that amazing knack. But you are described in the book as a secular Jew.
Right.
And so I think you have offered, at least on some occasions, the notion that you stand personally as a defeater or a disproof of the notion that every critic of Darwinian macroevolution is a fundamentalist.
I am a one-man multitude to the contrary.
Okay. In other words, you have good, we could say empirical or just, you know, commonsensical and logical reasons for questioning the adequacy of the neo-Darwinian paradigm.
Yeah, but here's the point. It's not only me. I'm very prominently displayed, mm-hmm. chiefly because I have nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to take risks that other people are unwilling to take. Mm-hmm. And it's not to my credit. I simply have nothing to lose. What are they going to do to me? There's no tenure position I can be denied. I'm not applying for a professorship. There's nothing. Mm-hmm. And I have no money to lose either. So
hopefully this broadcast will make you a few bucks on the sale of your
Yeah. I've taken a vow of poverty. It's fine by me. It's fine by me. But the point is, if you're in the same position as I am, you have a lot of correspondence and you speak to a lot of people. And I've got a lot of friends who prefer not to be named, believe it or not, mm-hmm. at Harvard and MIT and other very, very good universities. And the views that I'm expressing, and I know this will come as something of a surprise, I'm not unknown within the biological establishment. Mm. Not at all. Mm. And many people have independently come to the same conclusion. Not because they've read me, because they're good biologists. Mm. They know that they are skating on very thin ice. Yep. They really do. The shadows are lengthening, to mix the metaphors.
Wow. Let me just ask you to comment, if you could. I mean, Michael Behe, in his most recent book,
The Edge of Evolution.
The Edge of Evolution. I thought it was a terrific read.
So did I.
And he seems to me to almost gently force Richard Dawkins to jar himself out of denial and say that there is clearly in the landscape that we now have data, you know, data on the landscape.
Are you talking about physics or biology?
I'm talking about biology. Uh-huh. The landscape of the DNA, the genomes of malaria and human, you know, DNA. And so that we see that these mutations are breaking things. They're not making things. So it seems to me that the motor at the heart of this grand Darwinian theory, the motor mechanism of mutation selection, is entering the state of extreme crisis or maybe even meltdown. Would you concur?
I don't like to use the words extreme crisis or meltdown because so many biologists who are largely engaged in propaganda are prepared to sit up and woof loudly to the contrary. Mm-hmm. But what I would say is that if you look at the literature, and I'm talking about the technical literature, not the popular literature right now. Mm-hmm. You look at, for example, Michael Lynch's new book, The Architecture of the Genome, or you look at his research papers, and it's first-rate mind, absolutely no question about it. You will see that the underlying problems, as I would think of them, are being expressed from within the establishment. From within the establishment. Mm-hmm. And of course, they're being heavily disguised as open questions, and I suppose that's perfectly legitimate. I have no objection to offer at that. But what Lynch is arguing is not that mutations are inevitably harmful or deleterious. He's arguing a much more fundamental point, is that we can make no sense of the emergence of a completely altered biological structure if we simultaneously believe that at the level of the genome, the only thing controlling the behavior of the genome as it changes are roiling waves of probability which go back and forth but don't lead in any particular direction. Mm-hmm. Extremely interesting point. Mm-hmm. And of all people, Emil Zuckerkandel, mm-hmm. who is just livid with indignation at the thought of intelligent design. Mm-hmm. In an odd way, he concurs with his judgment. He says we don't have any explanation for the emergence of higher order complexity on the basis of what we know of the genome. Mm-hmm. And he thinks of this as, you know, one of those minor little problems that sooner or later we'll solve. But the admission, I think, is quite striking. I mentioned that in the book. Mm. It goes across the board now.
Right. You're listening to David Berlinski. David Berlinski, the author of Devil's Delusion, a new book from Crown Forum. And we're going to be going on a little bit deeper into this book and to the extraordinary controversy that has erupted around these topics and, of course, in the film Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed, which features David Berlinski and probably 30 other scholars who are involved in this discussion. You're listening to Darwin or Design. We'll be right back with more of our interview with Dr. David Berlinski.
Dr. Woodward will be right back with more on Darwin or Design, brought to you each week through the support of the C.S. Lewis Society. You can partner financially with the C.S. Lewis Society to continue reaching minds and hearts of thousands through Darwin or Design when you log on to apologetics.org. That's apologetics.org, or call 727-642-8574.
Yeah.
Welcome back to Darwin or Design. I'm on the phone today with one of my more exciting interviews I've ever had in this program's history with Dr. David Berlinski. Dr. David Berlinski is featured in my book, Chapter 11 of Darwin Strikes Back, under the title Unexpected Allies. I feature him with along with many other physicists and chemists and scholars from a wide diversity of fields who, without having any particular religious compunction or driving motive, come alongside and consider the theory of intelligent design as having a merit, as having some punch to it, and having some empirical basis. And so we're delighted to have on the other end of the line in Seattle, Washington, Dr. David Berlinski, who has just released this week. Is that right, David Berlinski?
April 1st.
April 1st, okay. It's just fresh out. I just got my copy. I'm holding it in my hand. Very handsome cover. Of course, the title on this handsome book cover, The Devil's Delusion. And on the back, I'm flipping it over, and I see from the Chicago Tribune the general comment. I hope it applies to this book. I'm sure it will. It says, David Berlinski plus any topic equals an extraordinary book. I like that. That's
me too.
Yeah, that's a literary addition equation that we can all cheer for. Under the praise for The Devil's Delusion, we have a friend of this program. We've had him on, I think, twice at least, Michael Behe, the author of Darwin's Black Box and Edge of Evolution. He says, with high style and lighthearted disdain, Berlinski deflates the intellectual pretensions of the scientific atheist crowd. Maybe they can recite the periodic table by heart, but the secular Berlinski shows that this doesn't get them very far in reasoning about much weightier matters. Dr. Berlinski, you're talking in this book, of course, about the issue, really, of metaphysics and the ability of, like, a scientific theory or a set of theories or even a scientific frame of mind to conflate up to or replace metaphysics or at least a route to metaphysics.
To a certain extent, when I discuss questions of cosmology, it's very much a matter of metaphysics.
Mm-hmm.
It's not my choice. It's what the physicists have encouraged me to discuss. But when I discuss issues about evolutionary psychology, I don't really think we're dealing in metaphysics anymore. We're dealing with the flamboyant inadequacy of current speculations.
Mm.
And I think a sharp distinction has to be drawn. Metaphysics is a better physics. I couldn't agree more.
Mm.
But not all issues are metaphysical. There is the simple glaring inadequacy of so much that passes as scientific discourse today.
Mm. What do you think allows that to go on with so little, calling out and, accountability, I guess is the word?
There is a good deal of accountability. There is a good deal of calling out. I mean, it happens. It doesn't happen fast enough for the likes of me. It probably doesn't happen fast enough for you.
Mm-hmm.
But it does take place. If you go back just as recently as 5 years and consider the immense worldwide fascination with evolutionary psychology, there's a good deal of healthy laughter about it now.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really need evolutionary psychology, for example, to explain why men like blonde bombshells,
mm-hmm.
which is a subject I discuss in the book because it's based on a real research report.
Well, that gets me wanting to zero in on some of these key chapters more than ever. I'm speaking in jest, of course. Your chapter, Knights of Doubt, I haven't had the opportunity to go through the book yet. I just got it within the last three or four hours. What is Knights of Doubt all about?
It's about the inability, which, of course, I share. I'm not exempting myself from this criticism.
Mm-hmm.
Inability expressed by philosophers, biologists, the entire intellectual group in society to find a coherent basis for a moral life.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to have exhausted a great many possibilities. We've reached at no settled conclusions. We're unsure how to structure a society.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a nagging doubt that by withdrawing any form of transcendental authority, divine authority, we have committed ourselves to a very, very grievous human error.
Mm.
But for the life of me, and I think for the life of anybody else, nobody knows how to correct or repair that error.
Mm. Well, let me just ask you a couple questions I think maybe a typical listener to our program might pose. Are you open, as a secular Jew who is affiliated with in various sundry ways with the intelligent design movement, but not necessarily a card-carrying member, but are you open to evidence that points to a transcendent source?
I'm open. How could you be closed to evidence?
Okay. All right. Well, as you look at it, would you see the rootedness of Judeo-Christianity, and I'm going to join Judaism and Christianity, in this kind of complex of two systems that are so close, of course, Christianity branching out from Judaism. Do you see the rootedness and the historical predictions let's say, made within Judeo-Christianity an opportunity to test the truth claims of that tradition.
You mean, for example, if there's a biblical claim made?
That such and such nation will perish. And if we study, let's say, Joel says, or Isaiah, and then that nation turns out is destroyed permanently. I mean,
No, I cannot give my assent to those doctrines. A flat-out point of skepticism.
That's interesting. I guess that's where you and I would, depart or go
sure.
down our different paths.
Sure, I'm willing to discuss it.
Okay. Well, I mean, let me just pose it in terms of if any religious system makes a historical claim and it appears to be supported by evidence, let's leave Judaism and Christianity out of it. If any religious system is making daring claims of the future and then they are confirmed, would that system then, just in a more general principle sense, have greater plausibility as it passes such falsification tests?
It depends on the level of specificity.
Mm-hmm.
To say that a certain historical religious tradition has made the observation that men are born rotten, mm-hmm. Or that Allah is suffering and death, that's not quite specific enough for me to say that a religious tradition has received something like confirmation.
Right. The one that I present normally is the Daniel 9 prophecy that 483 years after the issuing of a decree to rebuild Jerusalem, which is historically rooted to 444, the Messiah, the Prince, would be cut off. And it does seem to jibe well with the Judeo-Christian claims. But I'm getting off the track here. But in general, I think we're in agreement, at least with this notion, that the statements of the flat-out denial of the plausibility of a theistic worldview that we hear spouted or screamed from the rooftops by some of the more ardent Darwinian defenders, mm-hmm. or atheist defenders, lack plausibility when it goes into their scientific side. And I think that's your main point.
I think there's an enormous amount of inconsistency and hypocrisy in the claims.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and I have to say, I'm right there with everybody else. I'm not an exception to this rule.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to examining their own beliefs and the systems to which they give their assent and their credence, standards change radically.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as the chief chink in the armor of Dawkins? I know Dawkins, I'm sure, is one of the, your book even somewhat is modeled after Dawkins' title, The God Delusion, and yours is The Devil's Delusion.
Yeah, it's based much more on the wonderful Shakespeare quote that I've included, he must have a long spoon that must sup with the devil.
Okay.
That's what prompted the title.
Okay.
Although I recognize in retrospect there might be some similarities. I don't reject that. It's probably an unconscious influence.
Okay.
I don't think Dawkins has a chink in his armor. Mm-hmm. I really don't, because mm-hmm. he has transcended the ordinary critical ambit. He's become an international celebrity, and people like that don't have chinks in their armor. That is, by a chink in the armor, if you mean by a chink in your armor, a point of vulnerability for attack, mm-hmm. there is none. There is none. He is a permanent fixture on the celebrity circuit right now.
Mm-hmm.
People will continue to criticize him. Of course they will.
Mm-hmm.
But it will have no effect whatsoever.
That's fascinating.
No.
The point that he makes about the existence of God, I mean, his like one-stop shopping plan, if I can put in those terms, is any God, any potential creator of the universe and of life and of humanity would be infinitely more complex than the products that creator made. And therefore, it would need to have an evolutionary explanation itself.
Why is that so?
Well, I'm not. I'm presenting.
I know. I'm asking on behalf of Richard Dawkins' critics. Why is that so?
I would chime in. I agree that he's taking the definition. Let's say what we use as the definition, God, the uncreated creator, and he's like saying who created or who evolved the uncreated creator, so it becomes incoherent.
It's interesting that Richard Dawkins' entire argument was brilliantly anticipated by Aquinas and the Summa Theologica. I mean, there's nothing in Dawkins that Aquinas did not anticipate.
Hmm.
And he drew the obvious conclusion from the infinite regress that Dawkins is suggesting.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion is that God is a necessarily existing being,
mm-hmm.
not a contingent being. And therefore, the kind of questions and responses that you might mm-hmm. be able to trigger with respect to a contingent being simply don't apply. And I think this is the classic response of the theological tradition. Unfortunately, it is a tradition that Dawkins has failed to interest himself mm-hmm. in.
Do you see the movie that you appear in, The Expelled?
Yeah.
Do you see that movie accomplishing an educational function in the American culture today?
It's so hard to say. You know, I don't know what kind of response it's going to get. It's been very widely rejected by critics. Mm-hmm. Very widely rejected by critics, but that's just the first wave. Mm-hmm. So I have very little sense of how the film is going to do or whether it will perform any kind of educational mission. Mm-hmm. All I can say is let's wait a couple of weeks and see.
Yes. What do you say to the critics when they just attack it as reprehensible and despicable in linking Darwinian ideas as not a sufficient, but at least a necessary contributing cause to the Nazi regime?
What do I say about the critics? What a bunch of boobs. It's plainly an untouchable subject. Mm. It's plainly an untouchable subject because it's such a deeply painful subject. Mm. Nobody who's actively engaged in evolutionary biology wishes for a moment to suspect mm-hmm. that Darwin could in any way be inculpated mm-hmm. in the worst crime in human history. Mm. Nonetheless, when you examine the connection mm. and you ask yourself, is there a link between what Darwin wrote in 1859 and what the Nazis believed in, say, 1935, 6, 7, 8, 9? Mm-hmm. The answer that comes out of the historical record is the same as the answer prompted by common sense. Yes, obviously there's a connection. These mm. people were not reading the Gospels, after all.
I mean, it's such a painful and poignant and yet, compelling point that I think that, you know, anybody who has questions about this needs to read Richard Weikart's book.
From Darwin to Hitler.
We're going to be back for just a few more minutes. If you can just hang on just a few more minutes, David Berlinski. We're talking to the author of The Devil's Delusion, but you're listening to Darwin or Design. I'm Tom Woodward, your host. I'll be right back.
Darwin or Design, brought to you each week through the support of the C.S. Lewis Society. You can partner financially with the C.S. Lewis Society to continue reaching minds and hearts of thousands through Darwin or Design when you log on to apologetics.org. That's apologetics.org. Or call 727-642-8574.
Welcome back to Darwin or Design. We've been enjoying a terrific, exciting, and stimulating conversation with David Berlinski. David Berlinski is the author of the new book, The Devil's Delusion. And I'm ready, I'm primed to dive into this book. Just got it overnighted to me from Seattle, Washington, where David Berlinski is sitting in a hotel room. And we're delighted to be speaking not only to the author of The Devil's Delusion, but the one of the key figures interviewed in his home in Paris, France, his apartment in Paris, France, in the movie Expelled, No Intelligence Allowed. David, tell us a little bit about the reviews thus far. I mean, I understand there are a number that are in the oven, so to speak.
Of the book or the movie?
Of your book.
I haven't seen any print reviews yet.
Okay.
I think it's a little too early.
Yeah, I know the book just came out, literally just about a little over a week ago.
And tell you the truth, I'm like everyone else. I go to Amazon religiously to check what readers are saying. Some are good and some are bad. They seem to be split.
Like five-star and one-star?
Five-star and one-star.
Yeah.
And I've got to say, some of the one-star reviews are perceptive and interesting. I read them very carefully. I don't agree with them, but I appreciate the fact that anybody took the time to write them.
Mm-hmm. In your writing and your speaking on the topic of Darwinian macroevolution, the large-scale evolutionary theory, you have been known to be critical of the nature of the theory as containing a lot of storytelling, such as, you know, the stories of the evolution of the land mammals into whale form, and of course various and sundry whale fossils, alleged links between land mammals and whales have been found. But I think that you've made a point that there are a certain number of transitional stages or in between forms that would be necessary in that to make that string of intermediates a more compelling theory. I mean, could you just go into either that specific case or your perception of what the Darwinian theory is?
I think it's a very interesting case, a very interesting example, because it's certainly a case that strengthens a Darwinian point of view. I mean, you do have a transitional sequence that seems to point, and the origins of this sequence are currently under discussion in the literature. It's not clear. It seems to be some sort of ungulate, whether it's the size of a cow or the size of a hippopotamus or much smaller, much larger, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
But the intermediates have been found to the extent that there are six or seven intermediates now, the most recent Ambulocetus natans, which seems genuinely to have some characteristics of a land-dwelling animal and some characteristic of a sea-going animal.
Mm-hmm.
Even as far back as 1996, I said this is a piece of important evidence in favor of the Darwinian point of view, that there are transitions, and they have been found. They've been found roughly where they were supposed to be. But I go on to say that the question that really is never asked, and it's the crucial scientific as opposed to the anecdotal question, is, given the nature of the transition between a creature who lives on the land and a creature who lives in water, how many transitional steps or changes would you expect on the basis of current understanding of biological structures? How many? And I say, you know, I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations of no significance whatsoever, and I said you could easily justify just about any number that pops into your head, 5, 10, 50, 500, 500,000, 50,000. The point is not that the numbers are right or wrong. The point is the question's not really asked. And it seems an obvious question to ask of any kind of transitional theory, any kind of theory that bases itself on a continuous transformation between one form of life and another form of life, that it should give you not simply an off-the-cuff guess, but a theoretically determined guess about what you should expect in terms of the number of changes. If you knew the number of changes, the number of expected changes, you could compare it to the fossil record. Let's say, just for the sake of argument, 50,000 changes are needed to take a Chevrolet and turn it into a submarine. Let's say. And you only found six of those 50,000 changes. What conclusions might you draw about the plausibility of the theory? If there are 50,000 changes and you found 49,000, one conclusion might suggest itself. If there are 50,000 changes and you found six, another conclusion might suggest itself. If there are only 10 changes required to change a Chevrolet into a submarine, that requires a great deal of explanation about how the changes are all coordinated. And those ten changes must be massively coordinating in dominating, arranging a whole variety of other changes. Excuse me. So everywhere you turn in this theory, there are open questions. It's nothing wrong with open questions. The point is they're never asked, and still less are they ever answered. And that's what I have to say about that.
Okay. Well, that is very, very appropriate, you know, point that you bring out, is that some of these questions that seem to raise themselves in ordinary thought and just considering a fairly, you know, ambitious theory that nature would have to, you know, really perform quite a few amazing operations to move, let's say, the nasal passage from the front of an atypical land-dwelling mammal all the way up to the top of the head to form the blowhole. And, of course, which, from what I understand about whales, implies or requires the penetration of that air passage right through the esophagus. It's called mutual penetration structure. And, you know, and then maybe another, you know, a couple hundred other structures, which you've talked about on the wonderful DVD, The Incorrigible David Berlinski.
Yeah, there's no question that it could have taken place by Darwinian means. Stress on could have taken place. But for critics such as me, something more is needed. And I think anybody with a serious background in science, it's not enough to say it could have taken place. We want some numbers attached to this. That's the first step. It's the first step in getting beyond the anecdotal. I don't think it's unreasonable to ask for a number.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's unreasonable to ask for a number in a theory that says that so much can be happening in redesign of systems without any intelligence playing a role. Because
or something else.
Yep.
Or something else. We must never blind ourselves to the possibility that a completely different set of constraints may be at work. You know, for all that I know, those constraints limiting the space of possibilities, drastically circumscribing that space, or influencing its topology, for that matter, may be entirely chemical in nature. It's an exciting idea. I see no evidence that that is so, but it could be so.
Yeah.
We just don't know.
Well, I want to thank you for taking out, you know, nearly 45, 50 minutes of your time and perhaps delaying your lunch wherever you are out there.
Yeah, I ate before the show. Don't worry.
Okay, very good. Well, I can tell everybody that this is a regular listener of this program that we rarely have an opportunity to interview such an important intellectual figure in the world of theoretical.
I'm going to get off before you embarrass
me. Okay. Thank you, David Berlinski.
My pleasure.
I appreciate it so much. Best to you in the sales of your book.
Thanks very
Bye-bye.
Much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, Bill Carl, that was another barn burner.
Oh, my goodness. I like him best of all.
Yeah, well, David...
I like Dr. Silky the best before, but sorry, Dr. Silky, you're done in my book. It's all about David Berlinski.
Well, David Berlinski has been called the gadfly Oh, the Darwinian rump. In other words, he bites. He stings. And he's not one of us in the sense of being your typical, you know, biblical Christian.
Well, I think one of the things that is so fascinating about what we've heard today is it's coming from somebody who is so well-versed in philosophy. Mm-hmm. And somebody who's rooted in the scientific community say, well, of course, he's a philosopher. Mm-hmm. But then at a point in life, he made a transition to hard science as a mathematician.
Mathematics, yeah.
And so he comes at it from statistics and numbers and probability, too. Mm-hmm. And from both approaches is able to make a very fine argument.
And, you know, he is recognized, David Berlinski is recognized worldwide as one of the premier, perhaps the finest historian of mathematical physics in the world today. I mean, his book, A Tour of the Calculus, is considered the most important book ever written on how on the development of the theory of calculus. And in his book, Advent of the Algorithm, you know, award-winning book. His book, I haven't even mentioned Newton's Gift, dealing with the whole story of Newtonian physics. And I could name, you know, his Deniable Darwin, which when he wrote the Deniable Darwin, you know, in Commentary, which is not a Christian, you know, oriented right. magazine. It's published by the American Jewish Committee. Commentary got such a wave of angry letters, including from Dawkins himself and some of the top biologists in the United States. They had to devote 30 pages just to publishing the letters, and many of them were congratulatory. I mean, many of the fellow you know, thinkers along the lines of intelligent design said this is a major breakthrough, that you'd be willing, that Commentary would have the courage to publish the critique of Darwinian macroevolution by David Berlinski. And so he had to take 30 pages in the 2 months later in another issue just to print the letters and to reply.
To answer his critics.
To answer all of his critics.
Well, I think there's a couple of things that commend him. One is that he is a skeptic of things of faith as well. I thought that, you know, for him to say, mm-hmm. yeah, I'm not buying the Judeo-Christian line mm-hmm. was actually a commendation in this particular argument. And the other thing that stood out to me is his comfort in his own skin, mm-hmm. whereas Dawkins almost condemns himself. His chink in the armor, so to speak, mm-hmm. is he's formed such an outrage that he's formed a whole morality mm-hmm. based as in a reaction against mm-hmm. morality. And this guy is 180 degrees from that.
Well, in a way, the devil's delusion. I mean, I've just skimmed here and there. I've been actually kind of on the slides.
It's killing you. You haven't been able to read it, isn't it?
It's killing me. But I have been skimming the book, even as we were in our conversation, just, you know, a word here, a paragraph there. But this is a man who's in a search. He's in a search for truth, and he acknowledges the power of the scientific enterprise to gather truth in a certain constrained, in a certain limited way. But he's showing that to think that the scientific worldview is going to somehow, you know, rear its head and move in and effectively replace the religious worldview is to deny reality. It's basically to look at something that's an orange and say, okay, this orange can now run for president. No, an orange suits its own purpose, but an orange can never, you know, be a candidate for president. You need a human being. Okay, so it's almost like taking science, which has its place, and trying to push it to a whole realm of function, a kind of a set of tasks that it's not equipped to do. And I can't wait, again, as I said earlier in our interview, to give it a full read and then come back, and maybe we can have him, you know, do a follow-up interview when the dust settles. But I do want to, if you're listening to Darwin or Design, perhaps even for the first time, we do and welcome you to make this a regular habit. We're giving information on apologetics, specifically science is our main thrust, that's our beat, that's our emphasis, but we also go into other areas such as the writings of C.S. Lewis himself. The C.S. Lewis Society supports this broadcast each week. If you're interested in having me come and speak to your church or to your civic group, to your even school, maybe even a college class, just give me a contact. I can always be reached at the C.S. Lewis Society website, and the word is information. You can always reach us. Email is information. Spell out the whole word at apologetics.org. If you're interested in maybe coming alongside and suggesting a person to be interviewed, we're actually looking for Darwinian teachers, biologists, anybody who's on the other side of the fence. We'd love to have more people come alongside. We had a Darwinian biologist who wrote a book on evolution just come and be our guest a few weeks ago, and we hope to have a revisit with him. And so you may also maybe have an idea of some other topic you'd like us to tackle. We'd even be glad to hear from you on that. I do want to say that in the coming weeks, we have a lineup of terrific interviews, really terrific. One of them is an author of two books, Billions of Missing Links and What Darwin Didn't Know. His name is Jeffrey Simmons. He's a medical doctor out on the West Coast, not too far from where David Berlinski was today as we were interviewing him. Well, we want to just conclude the broadcast as we wind up this week by saying that the reason for our broadcast is to make known not only that there are chinks in the armor of Darwinian faith, but there is a basis for knowing the creator of DNA, creating a creator of your DNA, your mind, your heart, who you can know him personally. And he made himself known personally by taking human nature upon himself, the God of the universe, penetrating humanity, becoming one of us in the person of Christ. And Christ, of course, showed his love, showed his commitment to you and me by putting his life on the line, by taking our sin, by paying for it, by rising again, and by showing himself alive to his disciples. And so we're dealing with a proof that goes beyond science into the realm of eyewitness history. And that's what it's all about. And thank you for joining us on Darwin or Design. I'm Tom Woodward. See you next week.